I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Blues. Welcome back to The Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. I'm your host, Alice, and I'm joined, as always, by my well-appointed co-host, Brett.
Oh, thank you, Alice. It is always such a pleasure to talk to you and hear your descriptors, which are all about me and are not just clever puns about whatever it is we're talking about.
They're only clever puns. They have nothing to do with you, Brett.
I know. Well, see, when I describe you, I describe you from the heart.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of people helping you. Look, everybody loves a good pun. Maybe not everybody. I love a good pun. And you know what? I get to start these episodes, so I get to decide how I describe you.
That's true.
But I'm so excited, Brett, because you know what? We're recording at like 10 p.m. at night. And I think when we talk to people about us recording after our kids go to bed, they're like, oh, but you don't really record that late. Tonight is a late night. You're drinking gin and tonic. I'm a little loopy. Like, you know, it's going to be a great night. I can already feel the like fervor in recording. It's going to be awesome because well-appointed also is a play on words because we are talking about court-appointed lawyers today.
I know, our favorite topic. This is where we praise them. You know, we got that one-star review on the prosecutors because clearly somebody had needed a court-appointed attorney at some point and it didn't work out. And so they were as much reviewing that attorney as they were us because we always say that court-appointed attorneys, public defenders, federal defenders are some of the very best lawyers out there. And so I'm sure we're going to say that multiple times as we talk through this today. But I think this is a timely subject that people are interested in.
It really is because, well, there's a lot going on in the news, but let's give you a little bit of history. And we've already talked about this before. After Gideon versus Wainwright, everyone has the right to an attorney, whether or not they can afford them when it comes to criminal charges being brought against you. And that comes in three forms. In the federal system, it's federal defenders. In the state and local system, they are public defenders. And there's also panel or assigned private attorneys who are selected to represent clients. And the role of the appointed attorney is exactly the same as a retained attorney, but you don't have to pay for them if you can show an inability to pay. So the difference between an appointed attorney and a retained attorney practically is just a retained attorney. You retain them. And you retain them how? With money. So you pay them out of your own pocket. An appointed attorney is there's a finding by a court that shows that you don't have the ability to pay for representation. And so the court therefore appoints you an attorney and it does not cost you anything to be represented by that attorney. But the actual people who represent you, their job is the exact same. The way they sign their filings, the way they appear on any docket is just their name and their bar number. It doesn't say retained attorney or appointed attorney. That's irrelevant. They're held to the same duties of conduct and also professionalism. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what you can expect when it comes to an appointed attorney.
And it's really interesting. You're talking about these three different sort of forms of attorneys. The federal system, which, you know, we're the most familiar with, you have federal defenders. And it's an interesting thing because after Gideon versus Wainwright, there's not sort of a uniform way to enforce that right. So the Supreme Court basically says, look, everybody has to have access to an attorney. Money can't be an object. Money can't be the thing that keeps you from having a competent counsel. That's not justice. That's not a fair justice system. So we're basically going to say that the Constitution, when it gives you a right to have an attorney, it's more than just if you have the money, you can go out and buy one and no one can stop you from being represented. It's that you have to have an attorney and you can't be convicted without one unless you choose not to have one. We did a whole episode on Gideon. We won't go into all that now, but the actual putting that into place, it would be a really interesting thing. I mean, for nerds like me, I'm sure no one else would be interested in this, this sort of reaction to Gideon and how various places dealt with this. So the federal defenders, you might think, you know, you have U.S. attorney's offices. So every state is divided into districts. Your state may have one district, up to four districts. California and Texas both have four. Some states like Oregon have one. Some states will have more than that, even though they have less population than Oregon. It's not really clear why certain states have more districts. I don't know. But however many districts you have in your states, how many U.S. attorney's offices you have. The U.S. attorney's office is run by DOJ. It's part of DOJ. And you might think the federal defenders, is there some sort of, you know, federal government entity that runs this? And in reality, it's a sort of weird amalgamation where some districts have federal defenders offices. And I think most of them do now, but that wasn't always the case. There were some places that had them and some places that didn't. And it's kind of a, I mean, Alice, I don't know if you understand this better than me, but it's like a, it's almost like a charitable entity that I think receives some federal funding, but also some sort of private funding.
But there's a separate board that governs it as well. And so it's not really a federal agency the way, say, the federal prosecutors are.
Exactly. It's this very strange setup. And so the federal defender for any district, for instance, U.S. attorneys are political appointees. So usually when you have a new president, you'll have basically entirely new U.S. attorneys who will be appointed by the president. They'll be confirmed by the Senate, and then they run the U.S. attorney's office. Federal defenders are not like that. You know, the federal defender, the main person, is hired by this board. They may be the federal defender through multiple presidencies in 20, 25 years, right? And they're hiring people who act as these federal defenders. So it's a very sort of strange system in one way, but it is run by this board. It's approved by the local court system. The local court system, you know, sort of make sure they're doing a good job. I think if at some point the federal defenders stopped being good at their job, the local judges would probably complain to somebody and that might lead to changes in that office. But it's not like you might think it would be in this sort of very ordered, official federal government entity. It's the same thing in the states. Big cities will often have public defender's offices, which are, they hire people and it's their job to defend people who don't have enough money to defend themselves whenever they are indicted and prosecuted. But small towns often don't have that. So that's where this panel thing comes in. Essentially, what will happen in both the federal system and the state system is you have lawyers who are defense attorneys who ordinarily take paying clients who come in and pay them money. They sign up to be a part of this panel. And when someone is arrested and they can't afford an attorney, if there is no public defender in the state system, or if there is no federal defender in the federal system, or, and this happens too, if the public defenders or the federal defenders have a conflict, say for instance, there's a multi-person indictment and you have three people who were, you know, charged with a drug conspiracy, well, they may have conflicting defenses. In which case, you could not have, say, the public defender's office defending all three of them. There would be a conflict there between the attorneys. And so the public defenders might have one of those defendants, but then the other two need representation too. And that's when this panel comes in. So real lawyers who are just out there practicing law, hanging a shingle, you know, paying the bills like everybody else, they're sort of drafted into action. Now, they choose to be drafted into action, but they're drafted into action, and they are going to represent this person, and they will be paid by the state. There's a set rate that they'll be paid. Usually, there's a maximum amount they can make. Obviously, they can ask for more money if it's an extraordinary, complex case. And so that's the way it works. It's this sort of working together between people who this is their dedicated job to be the defenders of people who cannot afford it. And then you have these private attorneys who ordinarily might have paying clients who are paying them a whole lot of money to represent them. But they also, partly because defense attorneys, you know, they really believe in this. And people talk about this a lot. And I'm going to go on to the side here. People often criticize defense attorneys. you know, they attack defense attorneys because they're representing people who murdered people and murdered their kids and these awful, horrible people. And you see this in Delphi, you know, what a terrible guy. You know, he should just, he didn't even need a trial. They should just take him out and shoot him, right? And that's not how the system works, number one. And number two, defense attorneys typically, in the same way that prosecutors do, everybody's got their thing, right, Alice? I mean, we all were doing this for a reason, and it's not the money. We're doing it because we have a belief in the system. We have a belief in the process. We have a belief in the Constitution, and we want to help put it in action. And defense attorneys do that as much as anybody, and that includes defense attorneys who are out there in private practice. They also believe in the system, and they want to help people who can't afford it. And so oftentimes, they are happy to take these cases that they're not going to make anywhere near as much money as they would if this was a private client, but they believe in the system, and that's why they do it.
And there's practical reasons to that as well. Being a private attorney means you have to bring in your own work, and it's sometimes nice to have to build up reputation with the court as being a good attorney. And so that's one way, honestly, you can get your name out there is getting appointed these cases, doing a good job on them. People begin to hear about you because the jailhouse talks and also the court talks as well. So there are multiple reasons that these panel attorneys will be there, and they do get paid. So unlike public defenders or federal defenders who do not get paid by the court, panel attorneys who are appointed do get a stipend. It's going to be, like Brett said, likely much smaller than those attorneys would make in their typical hourly rates, but there is a cost to it for the court to appoint them.
And one thing people asked was, can they say no? And generally speaking, the answer is no, unless they have a reason. And by reason, I mean a conflict, like we talked about before, a legal reason not to take the case. If you're a federal defender or a public defender, or if you sign up to be on this panel and you get assigned a case, you have to do it. And you have to do the very best you can. You don't get to say, that's an unpopular case. I'm not going to take that one. Unless you have an actual ethical conflict, you can't back out of it. And one thing I think is really important to point out, there was this rumor going around on Facebook after the Delphi thing happened that, well, you know, appointed attorneys, their job is really just to make sure you have a fair trial and there's no appealable issues. It's not really to win the case. It's not to fight for you. It's not to be your representative. It's not to really go out there and try and win. And that is 100% incorrect. The way you ensure someone has a fair trial is you give them a zealous advocate. So a public defender, a federal defender, a panel attorney, whoever it is, they are going to fight for you just as much as if you laid down $100,000 and said, win the case. And that's what they're supposed to do.
And here's the thing. If you're watching, say, a trial that's televised, and you think that the defense attorney is not being as zealous because, oh, they know their client's guilty or not, if, in fact, the facts are really stacked against your client, sometimes the best advocacy is not to lose credibility with the court or with the jury by kind of screaming things and jumping up and down and pounding the table that this is all false when maybe all the DNA is there. You know, there's video. There's lots of eyewitnesses. Instead, it may be a better tactic just to hold the prosecution up to their standard for the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt and poke holes into their case in a quiet manner that maintains credibility with the jury. So just know that zealous advocacy can look different depending on the situation. And a good lawyer knows whether you're supposed to be pounding the table or sit back and let the prosecution either fall on its face or have enough holes poked into it that it fails to meet the burden.
And I'll give you an example of that, which is a little different from what Alice is saying. But number one, she's 100% right. I mean, a lot of times that's the best you can do. Sometimes the best you can do is save your client's life. And a good example of that's the Parkland case. There was, during some of the testimony in the Parkland shooter, one of the defense attorneys actually started crying. And there were people who thought that was ineffective assistance. If she's crying, then she's telling the jury they should find her client guilty. And I took the exact opposite. Number one, I think she was crying legitimately. I don't think this was a game. But my thought about that was, no, in doing that, she's showing that we can all agree how tragic this is, and yet she's still representing the person who did it. And to me, I thought that was a really powerful thing. And obviously, the jury chose not to impose the death penalty. I don't know how much that had to do with it, but sometimes that's the best you can do. If the evidence is stacked against you, the best you can do is try and get your client the best deal if it's a plea situation, or the best sentence possible. And, you know, look, you don't want to annoy the judge. I mean, this is like a very difficult thing if you're a defense attorney. If you're a defense attorney and you know you're going to lose because it's stacked against you, you sort of hold the prosecution to their burden, but you don't be so annoying that the judge is irritated at you and your client at the end of the day and decides to slam them with some big sentence. So it's hard being a defense attorney. I mean, it's hard in a different way than it's hard being a prosecutor. We talked about this before when we talked about the duties of a prosecutor. It's hard being a prosecutor because you have so many different clients and you have so many different things you have to think about. And it's easy on that side for a defense attorney because you have one client and you have one thing to think about. But it's hard being a defense attorney because a lot of times you are dealt a losing hand from the very beginning. And you have to take it and do the best you can with it, really against just unimaginable odds. I mean, if you're a prosecutor, you really should win 90% of your cases. If you're losing more than 90% of your cases, that's probably a problem. If you're a defense attorney and you win 10% of your cases, then you're like amazing. In real life, nobody's Matlock. You know, nobody is Perry Mason. They're not winning every case. They're winning very few cases because of that situation.
And let me be clear, the reason something's wrong if you're a prosecutor losing more than 90% of your cases is not because you're a bad lawyer. It's because you are not using that prosecutorial discretion and only bringing cases that meet the muster of beyond a reasonable doubt in the first instance. We've talked about how charging documents are very serious documents. Even though you only have to hop over the probable cause standard to get through the charging document, to get through a grand jury, if that's your standard, then you're not really doing your job, because an indictment can end someone's career, their life, you know, even if ultimately they're not convicted. And so the prosecutors are supposed to be looking at the long game and deciding what cases not to bring just as much as what cases should be brought. Whereas the defense attorney, they are then on the other side of that decision making. They only come in on the side after the prosecutorial discretion has been exercised, essentially culling out cases that should not be brought. And essentially, the prosecution should be bringing cases that are all convictable. And that's why if you're winning 10% of your cases as a defense attorney, like, kudos. That is really amazing. It's not that the judicial system is stacked against you, but if the prosecutor is doing their job, then that should be the outcome because of how serious and resource intensive the judicial system is when criminal charges are brought against someone.
And let me just say this, and this is the last aside, and then we'll move on. If a prosecutor ever says they've never lost a case, they're also a bad prosecutor, because that means they're not taking the hard cases that they should be taking because the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but there's difficulties there they have to overcome. If you win all your cases, you need to reevaluate what you're doing, because you are declining cases that you should be taking to trial, even if there's a chance you're going to lose.
That's a really good point. And real quick on the Parkland comment about the attorney, the defense attorney who is crying, you will see this oftentimes. Sometimes the best thing the defense attorney can do, and this is good advocacy, is to humanize their client, the defendant, to the jury. That means sitting close to them, even if they're being tried for a very, you know, violent, vicious crime, sitting close to them, touching them like on the arm in a manner that you would, you know, interact with normal people within society, essentially showing the jury that your defendant is not a monster, that they're just like the people sitting in the jury box. And so the crying thing may have been something akin to that sort of display. It's more than just your words, it's your actions as well as an advocate. Now, just because you want a free attorney doesn't mean you get one, because the line goes, if you cannot afford one, then you can be appointed one. Now, what does that mean? Because let me tell you, as lawyers, we know that legal bills can be extraordinarily high. And I don't know about you, Brett, but if I don't have to pay for something, I don't want to. But that doesn't mean everyone gets a free attorney. For one, it's much too expensive. And also, there would just not be enough attorneys who could make a living to do this, because, again, there are a lot of costs to litigating a case. So how does the court determine whether you cannot afford an attorney? What is the standard that they have to do? Well, this is probably pretty boring, but like most things in life, it usually takes the form of a form, a financial affidavit where you just list out your assets and liabilities and show to the court your inability to pay.
Yeah, and often this is pretty obvious. I mean, usually in our line of work, basically what happens is you show up for the initial appearance. And a lot of times at an initial appearance, because somebody just got arrested, they didn't expect to be arrested. You know, unless they're the Ramses, they don't have an attorney on call, right? So they're initially represented by whatever defender or whatever else is available. That person takes this initial appearance, and in that process, they sort of determine, are you guys going to go with an appointed attorney going forward, or are you going to hire somebody? And if you're going to go with the appointed attorney, you fill out this affidavit. And usually their assets are basically nothing. Their liability is really high, and it's very obvious. Now, on the margins, it can get tricky, but courts tend to side with providing an attorney if there's any doubt. Alice and I had a case once where the guy got arrested and he's brought in, and it seemed patently obvious that he could afford an attorney, but nevertheless, the court appointed the defenders to represent him. And we were kind of like, I don't know about that. And I thought, and I even said, can we challenge that? And Alice was like, well, it's kind of their budget. If they want to represent him, they can. He ended up hiring his own attorney because he absolutely could afford it. But if he had chosen to, he could have gone the whole way with a federal defender representing him, which is probably the better course.
And by the way, like, this was one of those instances where on its face, it was obvious that he had enough money because he had a current job and his salary was public and it was like in the six figures, you know, that sort of thing where it was like we didn't have to do much digging. It was just obvious on its face that he could afford an attorney. And it was almost perfunctory, the court kind of saying, OK, if you want one, I don't want this to be an appealable issue. Sure, you get one. But what I've always found interesting, and maybe each jurisdiction does it differently, but you do sign it, swear to it as an affidavit, but you don't have to bring any bank statements. You know, I've had to sign up for electric bills that require more checking of your background for financial ability to pay than getting appointed a court lawyer. And I think the reason that is that we have the constitutional right to an attorney to have representation when criminal charges are brought against you. And so it is not a high bar. I mean, usually these forms are passed out at that initial appearance. The defendant's attorney or the defendant, I'm sorry, the public defender that may be just in the courtroom working that day will help the person fill it out. And it could take a few minutes. It doesn't even take that long. And they have, of course, have to sign to it and swear their questioned about it on the record, and they affirm everything they've written down is true and that you should not lie in court because there are consequences to that. But it is a relatively easy process. It's much easier than getting approved, say, for a credit card.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this, whatever you think about the system and how it represents people and how it defends their constitutional rights, the one constitutional right that everyone absolutely is getting in this country is an attorney, because you're going to get one. I mean, there's just no question about it. If it's even close, and frankly, if it's not that close, you will get an attorney. And as Alice and I have said before, and feel free to be upset by this random listener who's been arrested before out there in the void, these people are really good. I mean, they are dedicated, committed people, lawyers who really believe. I mean, I'll just tell you, people who are federal defenders or public defenders, they're not doing it for the money, and they're not doing it because they couldn't get another job. Typically, these are the very best. I mean, I will just, as I have said before, I would rather face a retained attorney any day than people who do this, because they are really good at what they do, and they're very thoughtful, and they are really committed to their clients. And the one big myth in the legal system that I hope we can look, I love My Cousin Vinny. It's a great movie, but there's a part where they have a public defender and the guy's terrible. That's probably the least realistic part. Now, they are overworked 100%. They have tons of cases, but they are really good lawyers.
And to put it into perspective, I don't know what it was like at Harvard, Brett, but at Yale, I mean, we had a robust pipeline in the summers to do internships at public defender's offices across the nation. And they were some of the most prestigious internships you could get as a law student. And many, many of my classmates have dedicated their careers to be public defenders or federal defenders in their jurisdictions, you know, for a fraction of what they could be making in, say, a big law firm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, there would be, particularly in the big cities, there would be one spot available for an intern. And it was, people fought like cats and dogs over that spot. And one of my friends from Harvard who ended up doing that, he actually now is one of the leading sort of public defender slash opponents of the death penalty in the country. I mean, he's that's what he does. And it was really coveted positions. And that's the way it is. I mean, these are top. This is not, there is this thought out there that sort of bottom of the barrel lawyers who can't get a job anywhere else become, you know, defenders. And that is not right. They wouldn't get that job. The jobs are really competitive. And I'm just telling you, I'm not giving you legal advice, but if you're ever in a bind, my advice is to stick with whoever is assigned to you if you can, because the chances that they're going to care more about your case than somebody who's doing it is their job as their sort of firm, I think is pretty high. And I'm not criticizing firm lawyers because they're really good too. It's just the people who do it for a living, that it's their career, there is a commitment there that is just different. And they're not coming in a couple of cases here and there. That's what they do. They know the judges. They know the courts. They know the way everything works. They know what arguments they can make in front of particular judges that will be effective because they do it every single day. And it is completely different when you go into a case and you're facing a defender on the other side than if it is a retained attorney or even a panel attorney, because that's what they do. And it's just, I mean, you can believe me or not believe me if you want to, but they are really good at what they do. So why are we talking about
this? I was going to say, Brett, I think we made our point.
Yeah, we made our point. They're really good lawyers.
But why we care about
why
this?
Why are we talking about this?
Is because...
And you know, number one, we should get some love out there from defense attorneys, because we're called the prosecutors and we're giving you guys some love, so I expect some love back. But anyways, go ahead, Alex.
Okay. So, but the reason this is important right now, and a lot of you have asked questions about it, is because of the Delphi case. Richard Allen, who was arrested a few weeks ago on murder charges related to the Delphi case, initially said that he wanted to hire his own attorney. But then he sent the following letter that was handwritten to the court on November 9th. And you can read this letter. It's written on notebook paper, and you'll see there's a red stamp on it that says filed in court. So he can write a letter to the court because of the subject of what we're about to talk about now. He writes to the Carroll Circuit Court, and he lists the cause number and says, "In the cause listed above, I, Richard M. Allen, hereby throw myself at the mercy of the court. I am begging to be provided with legal assistance in a public defender or whatever help is available. At my initial hearing on October 28, 2022, I asked to find representation for myself. However, at the time, I had no clue how expensive it would be just to talk to someone. I also did not realize what my wife and I's immediate financial situation was going to be. We have both been forced to immediately abandon employment, myself due to incarceration, and my wife for her personal safety. She has had to abandon our house for her own safety. What little reserve there is will fail to even maintain the original residence. Again, I throw myself at the mercy of the court. Please provide me whatever assistance you may. Thank you for your time in this most urgent matter. Sincerely, Richard M. Allen." And that is a plea we hear often, actually, when people say that they want to retain attorney. They then realize, oh my goodness, it usually costs hundreds of dollars just to talk to someone, and then they have a retainer. And then if you go all the way to trial, it could be in the high six figures. So this letter came very recently, just in the last week.
And let me just tell you, I see stuff like this all the time. I mean, they must mass produce this particular notepad for every court in America, because, and the pen, because I just feel like I see this so often. And I'll get, you know, I get it in the mail because we always get a copy of everything that's sent to the court. And I open it up and there's some handwritten thing from some defendant. And usually it doesn't make any sense. And they all use this sort of over-the-top language, right? Like, I throw myself on the mercy of the court. The interesting thing about defendants is, typically speaking, they don't blame the prosecutor for whatever's going on. And they love the judge. They love the judge. The judge, it to them is like he's like God, right? You know, he may punish me, but he loves me too. And if I just throw myself on this mercy, he'll help me out, right? Like, all defendants feel that way. They love the judge. And so you see this kind of language a lot in these sort of handwritten things they write. So it's not surprising he wrote this. And it was successful. Shortly thereafter, he was assigned an attorney. His attorney is Andrew J. Baldwin at the firm Baldwin, Perry, and Camish. It's out of Franklin, Indiana. And they're going to represent Allen along with possible others, one of which we'll mention in a second. The firm is defense-oriented and touts itself as the place to go if you are facing serious charges, including murder. In fact, they have represented over 100 defendants accused of murder. You can check them out at criminaldefenseteam.com, which is a great website name if you're a criminal defense firm. And Baldwin is going to be joined by Bradley Rosie of Hillis, Rosie, and Dean. Now, Rosie's an interesting guy. He's been a private investigator, a corrections officer, and he is now a criminal defense attorney who has also tried murder cases before. Now, it's not unusual that you would be appointed a couple attorneys, particularly in a case that will be this complicated. Wouldn't surprise me if they appoint some more attorneys. But, I mean, these are good lawyers. I mean, these are going to be good lawyers. Baldwin in particular, if you look at their firm, you read some of the stuff about their firm, this is a rock-solid defense firm. I mean, these guys know what they're doing. They're going to put on a great case. If this goes to trial, they'll do a great job. I have to think, knowing what they know, there's a good chance they're going to push for some sort of plea here. But if they don't, this will be a good trial. There's no question in my mind Allen will have competent defense. Whatever happens at the end of the day, he will not be able to blame his lawyers if he is not successful.
Doesn't mean he won't try, because we always
doesn't
see
mean
that.
He won't try, because they always do.
But we're saying this ahead of time because I anticipate that if it doesn't come out the way he wants, he will certainly attack his attorneys. And we're telling you here now, I mean, looking at their bios, these are good, experienced attorneys who know what they are doing. And he, by the way, was smart to Richard Allen was smart to reach out for help in getting appointed counsel, because I don't think that the court would have appointed him anything less than really the best because of the high profile nature of this case and not wanting to take any chances on appeal with a potential ineffective assistance of counsel. And in other news, which is, you know, this case is going to be, you know, you guys had said, oh, nothing's going to happen until January when a pretrial conference is set. No, no, no. There's just going to be a lot going on between now and then. And the latest news is that the Carroll County Circuit judge who was originally assigned this case, Judge Benjamin Diener, recused himself soon after the press conference actually publicizing this arrest and the murder charges. And now Allen County Judge Fran Gull has been appointed to preside over the case. So another county's judge is stepping in place of the recusal, which isn't completely uncommon, especially in these smaller jurisdictions where there are not a lot of judges to spread out the work in.
And I'll just say, Judge Diener, it was way in over his head. You could tell by some of the orders he put out. He was not ready for this case. This was the right thing for him to do. I'm glad he recognized that. Basically, everything I've read about Judge Gull is, I think she's going to be really good. So that's a good thing. I think you're going to have a judge who's going to keep things on track, hold the prosecution and the defense attorney to what they're supposed to be doing. And if this goes to trial, preside over a really good, well-run trial. So personally, just looking at this, I think you've got a situation where you've got a good judge, presumably good prosecutors. The defense attorneys are not sort of out to make a name for themselves. They already are good at, they're good defense attorneys who were appointed. So I don't think you're going to have a Jose Baez situation here. So I think if this goes to trial, it's going to be a good trial that isn't a circus, and really sort of gets to the point about whether or not this person is guilty. and allows a jury to make a good decision based on the evidence.
I think that's right, Brett. And despite what makes good TV, what you want in an appeal-proof, solid legal conviction is essentially a boring case. You don't want theatrics, and you don't want shenanigans from the prosecution, from the defense, from the judge, from the jury. And this is being set up well for a solid case, which should make everyone feel better, because I know a lot of people have been a little bit nervous. You know, there's double jeopardy is a thing. So if this case is somehow messed up on the prosecution side, there isn't a second bite at the apple. He has been charged with double murder here. So, you know, we'll see how things unfold. But so far, these are the developments in the case. And, you know, I feel very, very confident that this is a good team. And by team, I mean prosecution, defense, judge moving forward. And we'll see how things unfold. But with that, Brett, is there anything else you'd like to add? Anything more you'd like to wax and wane about your love of public defenders? I didn't know you felt so strongly, Brett. It was like a love letter.
I just think they're great. I mean, it's funny because I think they're great, but I hate it when they show up.
I agree with you. They are very, very talented.
They're very talented. They're very committed. But, yes, you know, good for them and good for the system. No, I mean, look, we're going to be doing a lot of these where we talk about sort of different aspects of the judicial system as it relates to Delphi, because a lot of people are paying attention to this. And we just want to make sure that as this continues to move forward, you guys have a good understanding of everything that's happening and why it's happening. So we're going to do a lot of these. Obviously, continue to let us know if there are specific things you want to talk about that are unrelated to Delphi, just, you know, general legal issues. But we're going to do a lot of this on Legal Briefs because this is the place we can do it, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
Indeed. Well, thank you all so much for joining us for this episode, and we hope you've learned something, gotten a little insight from boots on the ground, and also got this update about Delphi. We'll continue to do so. But until next time, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is the Prosecutor's Legal Briefs.
Lovely gin and tonic.
Ooh, it's a Monday. Strong drink. Okay.
I do love gin. I mean, I love them all.
Gin is fine. Like, it doesn't, it kind of I used feels to not like my like nose gin. Hair burns.
I used to not like gin, and then I went to this great bar in D.C. It was called Second State, and there was this guy there. He's a bartender. Ross was his name. Uh-huh. He's now at, like, a Thai place in... I was somewhere out in the sticks. But man, Ross was the greatest bartender in the history of bartenders.